This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Vaccines, warm weather, and cabin fever mean more business for the Central Illinois Regional Airport, but it's not business as usual.
We would shift it so far the other direction to say it's probably 85% or so leisure.
Airport Director Carl Olson says usually there's an even split between business and leisure travel. Plus, working out from home has become just as much a thing in Central Illinois as working from home. Central Illinois claims a master storyteller who puts a little swash in that buckle. Johnston McCulley put the mark of Zorro on Chillicothe. And an ISU scholar writes a sci-fi film script. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring five doctors of audiology, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. Election officials predict above-average voter turnout for the city and township elections tomorrow. Consolidated elections typically have a lower voter turnout than general elections. Bloomington Election Commission Director Tim Mitchell says vote-by-mail ballots are higher this year than in past cycles. Mitchell says it could be carryover from the national election.
For instance, in Georgia this past week, you know, they passed a new law to impact voters down there, which, you know, has made national headlines. So I think the whole concept of voting is still forefront in people's mind.
Mitchell says average turnout for municipal elections is about 20%. He's projecting 25 to 30% turnout this year. Mitchell says last time there were 184 vote-by-mail ballots. This election, the BEC is seeing over 1,200 ballots. Mitchell said early voting is currently at nearly 1,400 votes. As far as managing the increased ballots in early voting, Mitchell says this election is a walk in the park compared to the general election last November. Home builders and realtors say Rivian Automotive's plans to hire 1,800 workers at its electric vehicle plant in Normal this year have put a major squeeze on the housing market. Tom Armstrong of Armstrong Builders in Bloomington says construction had nearly stopped at the Grove subdivision he built in southeast Bloomington, but lower interest rates and Rivian hiring spree in the last few months, he says, have caused demand for new homes to surge.
It's been sitting. We haven't been moving forward. It hasn't been going anywhere like this, and now we are looking at it going, how fast can we get this thing done?
Armstrong says he expects Peoria, Champaign-Urbana, and smaller communities outside Bloomington Normal will also benefit from Rivian's job growth. McLean County health officials are reporting 138 more COVID-19 cases over the weekend. That comes as the county testing positivity rate dropped more than a half a point. It's the first time in about a week the positivity rate dipped below 5%, but McLean County is still considered at a warning level by the Illinois Department of Public Health. McLean County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight says the county has only had to waste one COVID vaccine dose out of the nearly 75,000 administered so far. McKnight says the vaccines have a short shelf life because they must be stored in freezing cold. She notes a tiny fraction of COVID vaccines statewide have been scrapped.
1,600-ish total for the entire state that has given, you know, over 6 million. So that's a very low number. We do have protocols in place.
McKnight has said the health department will share unused vaccines with pharmacies and other health providers to make sure they get used. She says the county had to throw out the one vaccine dose because of a bad syringe. The Pfizer vaccine must be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius. That's colder than Antarctica in winter. A longtime public defender in McLean County is the new head of the office. Ron Lewis has been appointed to replace Carla Barnes, who became a judge. Lewis has spent a quarter quarter century in the public defender's office. He's a native of Pontiac, Illinois, and lives in Bloomington. Lewis went to John Marshall Law School. Lewis says he values the unique partnerships across many organizations to meet the diverse needs of clients and the broader justice system. A proposal advancing through the Illinois General Assembly would allow candidates for public office to use political committees' funds to cover caregiving costs. Senator Melinda Bush is a Democrat from Grays Lake. She says the idea would boost the number of women running for office because caregiving duties are most often fulfilled by women.
Many times, women are particular. There's a deterrent because they have children and or adult care dependents that live with them, and there's just no way for them to get out and campaign.
17 states already allow campaign funds to be used to hire caregivers. The Federal Election Commission also allows campaign funds to be used for caregiving. A similar effort considered by the legislature 2 years ago failed. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
They truly have changed my life. I have a better quality of life, and to just be able to have the empowerment that I have and the confidence that I've been able to gain.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Things are looking up at the Central Illinois Regional Airport. Passenger loads are stabilizing after a year of next to no travel. Airport Director Carl Olson says it's not a full-blown recovery, but the size of the year-over-year decreases has been getting smaller. WGLT's Dana Vollmer talks with Olson and Deputy Director Fran Strebing about how business has changed as a result of the pandemic.
Typically in the past, CIRA has been more of a 50-50, right? About half our traffic is leisure and about half our traffic is business. At this point in time, we would shift it so far the other direction to say it's probably 85% or so leisure and probably around 15% business. And that's because, of course, people are working remotely. It's involved, you know, there's not business travel. People aren't making a lot of calls on clients, or they're doing things online or on the telephone. And so that's caused a reduction in the business travel. Coupled with the nicer weather, the effectiveness of the vaccination strategy, people wanting to get out and reconnect with family and friends, go on a vacation, get out of a house. And so we're seeing an increase in leisure while there's still that depressed level of business travel.
Where are people going on these leisure trips, Fran?
Florida primarily, from here. You know, we have a lot of Florida service between Frontier going to Orlando International and Allegiant going to Orlando Sanford Airport and St. Pete Clearwater. So we have a lot of Florida traffic. And then Delta, of course, with their connections through Atlanta, they're also seeing a lot of folks connecting through Atlanta to go to other Florida destinations. So south and west seems to be where people are headed these days, where they can get outdoors, they can be outdoors, more adventurous travel going west, hiking, and you know all the things that you think of in the great outdoors. So we're seeing them mostly domestic, of course, and I think also at this point we're starting to see people visiting family and friends.
If companies continue conducting a lot of their business virtually, how does that kind of reposition regional airports like CIRA, which traditionally do have so much business travel?
Well, I think a very good question. I think in our case here at CIRA, we're well positioned. We're in a good position because for the leisure travelers, we have two low-cost nonstop service providing airlines to go to the leisure places, but we also have two mainline large global network connecting carriers that not only get people out of Central Illinois, Bloomington Normal, to business destinations, but it brings the world and it brings business people into our community. And I believe there's always going to be a need for business travel. I think COVID has driven changes in practices and policies and protocols, but there's always going to be some demand for business travel. You need to call on clients. You need to put project teams together. You know, you look locally. You look at a company like Rivian, that is expanding their plan and producing vehicles, and is bringing business people into the community each week. So there's going to be a demand for business travel. We think it's more a question of how fast will the business travel come back, and to what level? Maybe in the future, is it still going to be around 50-50 mix for us, or is it going to be 60-40, 60% leisure, 40 business? We don't know yet. It's too early to tell.
In the meantime, are there things that the airport can do to kind of pivot and focus more on leisure travel?
We've always offered some things that people that are traveling for leisure reasons should be aware of and enjoy, right? The free parking has been a huge thing for us. We've always had it, and we use it as a marketing tool, and it does help attract people. We have, you know, a smaller atmosphere than big city airports, so it's easier, it's less hassle, it's less driving, and the fact, as Carl mentioned, that we have both two low-fare carriers that offer flights to destinations that folks really want to go to, especially families, I think it continues to appeal to people. Not everyone enjoys even one low-fare carrier in the region. So for us to have two, and Denver service will be coming back here in April with some multiple destinations, it really gives us an advantage.
That's Central Illinois Regional Airport's Fran Strebing and Carl Olson talking to Dana Vollmer. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. Working from home has become a thing during the pandemic. So too has working out from home. Jen Blair does personal training at the fitness studio she owns in Bloomington. In this edition of Sound Health, Blair tells Eric Stock business is up 20% over pre-pandemic levels as more people learn to exercise from home or in a small studio. But Blair says it was scary when the pandemic hit, and she didn't know when clients could return.
You know, if I don't work, I don't get paid, but at the same time, I still have gym bills that are due and I'm bringing in no income. So that was very scary, and having that happen for 10 weeks was pretty scary. But I have amazing, awesome, like faithful clients that are all like my family. So I had a good handful that wanted to do Zoom sessions. So that worked out great. We, you know, set it up and did our regular times that we would work out. So 2 to 3 times a week. And I would do it in my basement. They would do it at home. Initially, some of them even started out with just body weight workouts because they didn't have any equipment at home. And then they would start to order stuff on Amazon and get more equipment. So then we could bump it up a little bit. So that was great because I was working out every day with my clients and getting to see some of those faces. Not everyone, you know, did that, but I had a handful that did. So that was still awesome.
How did your clients' habits change for working out?
So I would say, you know, it's kind of a mix. I have a client page and I would post workouts on there for them 3 times a week. So I liked to still kind of check in with them and make sure that they were doing their own workouts at home on their own. I know some were, and some came back to me that first week that I was opened and were so honest, and they were like, hey, I didn't do a thing while we were off. you know, and I understand it's a scary time for everyone. It's different for everybody. So that was okay too. And we just picked right back up where we left off. I know some people, you know, felt great and they had more time at home with their kids. So they were getting the whole family involved and they were all working out as a family, which was great. And some of them told me they were working out, you know, 5-6 days a week, going on runs with their family. And that was great. So I loved kind of getting texts each day from everybody. But I know when the gym opened back up and we could get back to doing things like rope slams and punching bag and sled pushes, that everybody was super excited to, you know, kind of get some of that bigger stuff that they don't get to do at home.
So what are the common questions you get from people who have worked out at a gym up until now and they couldn't get there anymore, but they want to stay active?
Well, a lot of people are wanting to know what they could do with their own body weight if they didn't have weights. And, you know, during the pandemic, weights were really hard to come by. I mean, I had some people that couldn't get any weights for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. So we had to get really creative with what we could do, even getting outside and getting some fresh air in their backyard. And everyone just kind of wanted some extra health and nutrition tips also. I would try to post for my clients different meals that I was making at home, healthy things that they could kind of duplicate at home with their family since restaurants were closed. And so even though it was a really tough time, I think for some people it was great to kind of cook more often, where maybe on a regular basis they weren't cooking as much, weren't using as much fresh ingredients and that type of thing.
Are there practical substitutes for actual weights, things that you would recommend people use?
Oh yeah. I always tell people, you can grab anything. You can grab a can of black beans. You can grab a bag of flour. You can grab whatever you have at home to kind of throw in there for your weights. You can use a bench or a chair to do tricep dips. Anything you have around the house is perfect. Anything that you can pick up and is comfortable to hold.
What are the common mistakes that people make trying to work out from home and they don't have the structure that they are used to in a gym?
Well, I would say one of the biggest things is form. That's why I really like in-person, you know, sessions so I can watch everybody's form really, really closely. If they get some kettlebells and that type of thing, and they're trying to do things at home, oftentimes their form can be off and they can hurt their back or hurt their knees. So that was definitely more tricky whenever I was doing personal training sessions on Zoom, because I really had to look closely to make sure I was watching everyone's form really good.
Now, a gym can be intimidating for some, but for others, they sort of look for that separation from home to focus on it. Has the work from home model changed that for people since we're doing everything else from home now?
Well, I would say for some of my clients, they're still working from home and they haven't gone back to their office yet. So for some of them, they really like that flexibility to where they can come into the gym, maybe over their lunch hour, where they normally wouldn't have time to get to my gym over their lunch hour and work out and then get back home. So that type of thing has been nice for some people and they've really liked that part of it. I know that a lot of people working at home, they're loving to come back to the gym to kind of get that social hour as well, because they're not getting that at home sitting in front of the computer all day long.
That's personal trainer Jen Blair with Eric Stock. Blair says she plans to offer a mix of in-person and virtual training sessions in the future. An Illinois State University faculty member from the Broadcast Education Association has been recognized for a film that might go beyond science fiction and into reality. Student reporter Katrina Peterson talks with ISU professor John McHale about the parallels the film has and the way the sci-fi genre looks in a post-COVID era.
The idea for the screenplay originally was looking at some of our harshest and most inhumane policies and thinking about what would happen if they were extended to their logical conclusion, and what we're left with, with an ecologically devastated landscape ruled by corporations. Rocky in particular was separated from her family at the border because they didn't have the proper paperwork, so she was placed in an internment camp where she escaped the brutality at age 4.
Rocky joins a group of eco-defending freedom fighters as they protect their home and defend their neighbors. Why couldn't she go in alone?
She starts as a scrappy scavenger on her own with her dog Buck. But while saving a family from these marauding militias, she is injured and the Eco Front takes her in, and she's kind of forced to a certain extent to face the question of whether she wants to join with others and join a family and work towards the common cause of protecting their fertile valley and protecting their neighbors from the marauding militias.
Eco Front is an action-adventure sci-fi feature film. Are you an avid writer of sci-fi, and what challenges arise when writing sci-fi specifically?
I've written 16 scripts, and this is really the first foray into science fiction. And when I say science fiction, there's also a heavy action-adventure element. But the film functionally is a post-apocalyptic film. If global warming happens, and if a lot of the policies of the previous administration that fostered and promoted chaos were pursued to their logical conclusion, Rocky would face a very different ecological, political, and economic world. And a lot of the film is her trying to adapt to this new world, and in the meantime, create the human bonding of the family.
With COVID-19 and multiple conspiracies circulating, for example, the COVID-19 virus conspiracy that someone released the virus on the people on purpose, do you think writers have an obligation to not indulge in those? And do sci-fi films foster conspiracy theories?
Where do sci-fi films go in a post-COVID age? In EcoFront, we integrated the idea into the film. Actually, we called it COVID-29. And when Rocky enters the camp of EcoFront, they're careful to test her and make sure that she doesn't have the disease. I certainly don't ever want to feed into conspiracy theories, but what was one of the interesting things about my script is that the very first scene is a riot at the Capitol caused by economic and social division that is certainly fed by conspiracy theories. People, quite frankly, are buying varying different narratives of how the world really works. So for me as a writer, and for any writer of scientific or science fiction, we would want to think about what conspiracy theories are we perpetuating, or is global warming actually a scientific fact? And so we do have a responsibility to not feed into conspiracy theories.
The Best of Competition Award in Film Writing is an evaluation of all the film scripts written and submitted by faculty members from among 250 schools represented by the BEA. What about this award sticks out from the others you may have received?
So I have won a number of awards for my film scripts, but this Best in Competition Award from BEA represents the best of the best of writers who are employed by universities, of faculty members that are actually writing film scripts. So this film script in particular and this award is really a peak for my professional recognition so far within the film writing community.
John McHale spent time teaching in Stanford and Yale University, as well as co-wrote The Primary Decision, a functional analysis of presidential debates. The book published in 2001 and received 7 academic awards. Professor McHale, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm Katrina Peterson.
John McHale says he worked on the 120-page script for more than 8 months. McHale says his daughter Maggie and his School of Communication colleagues inspired him. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Small towns across the country looking to brand their community have learned the importance of recalling hometown heroes. It should come as no surprise, then, that Chillicothe refers to Johnston McCulley, the creator of Zorro, as the town's master storyteller. Correspondent Steve Tarter speaks with Diane Colwell of the Chillicothe Historical Society.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. There was an article in the Chillicothe Times Bulletin with a photo. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I've lived here basically most of my life, and I never knew anything about this. And it turned out that our mayor, Don White, had taken a book out of the library from way back when, and he discovered this story about McCulley and the Zorro connection. And he told another person, which told Mary Ann Gillespie, and she put it in the paper, and I thought, well, somebody will surely do something about that, but nobody did. So in later years, I said, well, let's do something about it to Gary Fike. And Gary Fike's our good researcher there at the museum.
Right.
And so he spent a lot of time researching the family, and we have a timeline posted on the board that tells a lot about what he discovered and what was going on in Chillicothe and the world at the same time, to kind of get a feel for the time period.
And, you know, it's always interesting how when you have a celebrity, I guess we can call Johnston McCulley a celebrity, because though he wasn't known, probably isn't known to a lot of people, when you tell folks, hey, this is the guy that wrote Zorro and many other stories, then it's like, oh, you know, and so there's an interesting factor there. But you can really rally behind a guy like that or an individual like that because of the interest in the public now in all things.
Right. Well, as you saw on our sign, we call him our master storyteller.
Uh-huh. And that's a good example. You have a lot of memorabilia about the McCulley and the works that he did. You've gathered together magazines from many years back, and certainly pictures of Zorro. You've got all kinds of things. Will those be on display, or is that something people can see? Maybe you'll plan to have them come into the Historical Society.
The reason we have such a vast collection there is due to an artist visiting and finding out we were going to do a small display and allowed $500 to do it. And I met him in the library as he was coming here to do research with Johnston McCulley. He has a huge collection, and his name is Peter Poplaski. He he found out we were serious about it, and he brought part of his collection to us. So much of what you see is due to his collecting.
He's quite a character, Peter.
Yes, he is. He's a lot of fun.
Well, you got to have a Zorro fan to promote Zorro. One of the things that you've brought out, and I think you and Gary and others that have been involved in this research effort in Chillicothe, Zorro and McCulley played quite a role in sort of the superhero genre that's so popular now, that every movie seems to be a blockbuster superhero movie. That they may have started, or at least got a good kickoff with Zorro.
Well, the people that came up with the Batman idea credit Zorro for some of their ideas. And everything just kind of went crazy after that. As you see, some of this stuff is really wild now for some of superheroes, but it's been fun. It's been fun to watch.
That's Steve Tartar speaking with Diane Colwell of the Chillicothe Historical Society about the town's master storyteller, Johnson McCulley, the creator of Zorro. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.